Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, welcome to the end of the third quarter. We made it through the credit crunch, all right. Wall Street is basically stable. Big deals are starting to get done once more. But then again, oil's near a record high. The dollar's down the drain, and not everybody's convinced the worst is over. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy, happy Friday, everybody. It's the 28th of September today. Good to have you with us. Oil is, almost all over the world, what's called a dollar-denominated asset. When a country forks over cold, hard cash for light, sweet crude, payment is due in American greenbacks. At one point today, you needed 83 of those dollars to buy a single barrel of the stuff. With no shortage of oil at refineries, our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshea looked into why those prices are so high.
OPEC just raised oil output this month, so supplies are plentiful. Tim Evans of Citigroup says the weak dollar is pushing prices higher.
When the U.S. dollar falls, investors look to other assets to preserve value. Typically hard assets, like a commodity. That commodity could be gold or copper or oil. That is more or less the knee-jerk reaction.
It's not quite a tulip craze or a dot-com bubble, but experts say speculators are streaming into the commodities markets. Stephen Shork is an analyst and trader in Pennsylvania.
Everyone that I speak to, even my friends who are lawyers and doctors, they all want a piece of this.
Oil is a particular favorite. Tom Closa is an analyst at Oil Price Information Service. He says the weak dollar is only part of the reason that oil went from $50 in January to $83 today.
If I were looking at an explanation, the weak dollar would be an ingredient in it, but it would be sort of like salt as an ingredient in an Italian gravy. It'll give it some of the gusto or whatever.
Closa says the real reason prices are rising is because of those speculators. They're gambling on rising demand in places like China. But Closa and Citigroup's Evans both say worldwide demand isn't growing as fast as people think. They say there's a danger these high oil prices could come crashing down. Evans calculates that oil should really be trading at $65 a barrel. In New York, I'm Jill Barshea for Marketplace.
Economic tea leaves are hard enough to read even in the best of times. Those oil prices Joe was just talking about are just one example. After tickling an all-time high, today crude slipped at the close to finish down $1.22 at just over $81.50 a barrel. Two other things happened today that seem to contradict themselves as well. The network equipment maker 3Com sold itself to a private equity buyer for a not insignificant $2.2 billion. That's a hefty sum in these days of tighter credit. And that guy named Greenspan popped his head up again and said some not-so-nice things about the U.S. economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the European desk in London.
The days when he made opaque, impenetrable comments are long gone. When he spoke here on BBC Radio this morning, Greenspan made it perfectly clear he's now more pessimistic about the American economy.
The danger of recession has obviously risen, but in my judgment, and I suspect looking at the forecasts of most American economists, is that it's still less than 50-50.
Many European economists share his view that the likelihood of a recession in the U.S. is increasing and that the main reason is falling house prices. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank.
It's quite clear that the housing bubble has burst. An awful lot of people had debt that was collateralized by their houses. And whether they will actually spend money in September and October and November seems to me quite problematic.
Today's buyout of 3Com seems to belie that pessimism. U.S. private equity firm Bain Capital Partners raised more than $2 billion to do the deal. So plenty of money out there. The boom goes on. Don't kid yourself, says London fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart.
There is a huge credit squeeze going on around the world, and that's going to put a big stop on new merger and acquisition deals. Those that are still in the pipeline and have the financing can go ahead.
And he says it's worth noting that a good chunk of the money to pay for the buyout of 3Com came from a place where no one is forecasting recession, China. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Believe it or not, as the third quarter ends today, all three major indices are higher than they were 3 months ago. We'll have the details and we'll check in with the stockbroker down in Dallas when we do the numbers. American consumers clearly don't give a hoot what Alan Greenspan says. Looming recession or not, we bumped our personal spending up more than 0.5% last month. The Commerce Department said this morning we're spending money at a rate we haven't seen since late spring. And it's not just us. In Singapore, decadent consumption is quickly becoming the cornerstone of a booming economy. Rents there are up as much as 50%. Multi-million-dollar condos are gobbled up by foreign investors. And Singapore has now passed New York as one of the world's most expensive cities. Along with that boom comes a crop of goods geared toward those in the higher echelons. Rachel Louise Snyder reports now on one such symbol of excess.
They call it the most expensive cigar in history.
Cohiba Behique.
And I'm standing in the only place you can buy it in Singapore with Jimmy Young, who calls himself the Cigar Man. Only 100 boxes of 40 Behique cigars each were made, all rolled by a woman in Havana named Norma Fernandez, who certifies each box. The total number of Behique boxes to make it to the Asian continent is a whopping 4. The other 3 are in Hong Kong.
And what did you sell this box for?
I sold it for 85 last week.
Sing dollars, right?
Which is about 55,000 US.
The humidor is made of ebony bone and skate skin. Jimmy holds it like an oversized diamond, which it sort of is. Chris Leboutelier, an American expat, has been coming here for a decade.
Very few entrepreneurs are as good as he is at identifying a specific niche market like he has. He has taken cigar smoking and the whole world of cigars and actually built it into a club.
The club is part Jimmy, part self-selection, meaning you have to be willing to let a lot of money quite literally go up in smoke. Jimmy, half-smoked cigar in hand, shows me another box that sells for $90,000.
Is this Fidel Castro's signature that
yes.
I'm looking at?
Yes, that's Fidel Castro's signature. Usually the signature commands 80% more.
Even without Fidel's signature, the sale of Cohibas is brisk. But fakes abound. Thanks to the U.S. embargo against Cuba, Americans who drop wads of cash for the real deal are getting ripped off. Even the Americans who go to Cuba are getting fakes because Cohibas command such high prices that Cuba exports them. All of them.
Yeah, everyone claims that they bought Cohiba, but they are all fake.
Jimmy talks about cigars like art dealers talk about Modigliani.
I like to sell cigars to people who know about cigars, not come in with a lot of money. I will not even show them my rare cigars. They're waiting for the right owner.
In fact, his club doesn't even have a name or an address. All I can say is that it's connected to the Regent Hotel.
Well, I like to keep this place as discreet, undisturbed. You need to prove you are a good character customers. My staff will then introduce you to my world.
Apparently, my character squeaks by.
Do you smoke?
Do I smoke? I'm American. Of course not.
You don't smoke, okay. If you smoke, then I'll give you a Behique later. We smoke together.
That was a trick question.
I guess you'd say I was close, but no. Okay, sorry. We go into the elegant smoking room, decorated with Cuban paintings, black ceilings, and low lights. A VIP room next door holds cigars so rare it's insured for $3 million. To get into that room, you need to be
royal family, multimillionaire, big guys in Asia.
Guys not like Chris, who's smoking a
Sancho Panza, $15.
Like me, he squeaks by on character, too. Chris gives me some pointers.
When you light a fine cigar, You don't want to use something as silly as like a Zippo lighter or a match because it has sulfur, which leaves a residue, if you will. So what you do is you actually light the cedar and then you light your cigar with the cedar.
Until the embargo is lifted, Americans will just have to settle for fake cohibas. Or maybe take a trip to Asia. But like Chris says,
to be a member of the club, you gotta know Jimmy.
In Singapore, I'm Rachel Louise Snyder for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Hello, David. How are you?
Oh, isn't it so nice? What a relief to have this quarter over with.
I'm a little amazed, actually, you're saying that, because if I read the numbers right, you guys did pretty well this quarter, all things considered.
Oh, I know, but look, it was just, I mean, this was like pulling teeth. Go back to July and look at August, and this thing was just terrible. I mean, that sell in May and go away thing was working right up until just about the first part of September. I mean, Kai, remember, the world was coming to an end, and the subprimes were going to drag us all into the hole, and we're going into a depression, and you remember all that stuff?
And it was terrible. I do remember all that stuff.
And we're sitting here, and we've got five straight up quarters for the Dow Industrials Average, for the S&P, and for the NASDAQ, and I'm telling you, I feel like a man who's been shot at and missed. It's that wonderful feeling.
Why don't you feel better? Why don't you feel better, though, right? I mean, there is this sense of, like, emptiness that it all ended this way, isn't
there? No, I think it's a lot better. And look, don't worry. We're staying on our toes. Now we've got the whole world just openly, just out in public in front of children using the R word.
Yeah, well, not only just the whole world in front of kids, but no less a person than Alan Greenspan. We heard Stephen Beard telling us about that at the top of the show.
Yep, going from a third to something less than a half. I think that's a nudge. And then, but it wasn't just that. You know, it wasn't just him. It was the CEO of Freddie Mac, who said he thinks there's a 40-45% chance of recession. And Bill Clinton said that. You remember him?
Yeah, I do.
And Goldman Sachs chief economist Jim O'Neill, what did he say? He thinks it's more likely we're going to have a recession, and the growth rate in Japan, the U.S., and the EU is slowing down. So look, we got plenty to worry about, and that's good.
What does the mighty David Johnson say, though?
I think it really doesn't matter. I mean, because the fact is, first of all, in the market, you have to be able to adapt to anything. But if you look back over the last 60 years, there have been 10 recessions, all right? 10 mm-hmm. recessions. So, they're not that uncommon. They come along fairly frequently. And six of the 10, the Dow actually gained ground during the recession. Hmm. Four, it was down. So, you know, you could handle it.
I suppose I could.
You know, a lot of companies are buying back their own stock. Did you see Chevron this week? They're buying back like $15 billion worth of their stock at mm-hmm. Lockheed and ConAgra, Wyeth. So that gives you a little support underneath the market. And companies are still innovating. The earnings may not be great, but at least they've got growth prospects. Even AT&T, which only gets like 4% of the revenues from outside of the country, says now they're going after, you know, China, Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, yeah. Kuwait. They're going to try to grow their business. Of course, they're probably going to have to change their name from, you know, American Telephone and Telegraph.
Change it to what?
Maybe WorldCom.
Yeah, we've been there. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Guy.
Oh, WorldCom. Yeah, you too. Coming up, Elks Clubs beef up their membership.
Anywhere else on the strip, a beer go for $4, $5, $6. You come here, the most you pay is $2. You know? You can't get that nowhere else. You know?
But first, let's do the numbers. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 17 points today, around a tenth of 1% to wrap up trading at 13,895. The NASDAQ was off 8 points, 0.3%, finishing at 2701. The S&P 500 lost ground for the first time in 3 days, by the by, shaved off 4 points, 0.3% to close at 1526. The weekly numbers look better. The Dow up a 0.6% since Monday. The NASDAQ gained better than 1%. The S&P 500 advanced a 0.1% on the week. The stock market's performance for the quarter, the just closed looks even better. The Dow up 3.6% over the past 3 months. The Nasdaq gained 3.8%. The S&P 500 added 1.6%. Overseas, London and Tokyo were down. The price of the 10-year T-note was down as well. That pushed the yield up to 4.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday, October 1st. In Detroit, automakers release sales figures for September. In Washington, the White House starts a new fiscal year. And a conference opens in The Hague to mark World Habitat Day. Organizers will focus on urbanization and the safety of cities. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It can take years or longer for a new drug or medical device to get to market. Even after all the research and development, before the Food and Drug Administration will stamp its seal of approval, the drug or device in question has to pass a set of clinical trials. In theory, those are rigorous and closely controlled tests involving hundreds of people. But a report out today from the Health and Human Services Inspector General says nobody's keeping an eye on the testers. Helen Palmer has the story from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH.
Nobody from the Inspector General's office was available to discuss the report. But one longtime critic of the FDA, Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, calls the state of human research protection very bad indeed.
Only about 1% of the 350,000 sites where these experiments are going on are ever really viewed.
Grassley says there are only 200 inspectors, and there's no central registry of research sites. Also, there's no single agency in charge. The FDA and the Office for Human Research Protection each have partial oversight.
That division and the low resources to each of them has not been a good mechanism.
Ezekiel Emanuel's a bioethicist at the NIH. He says at the moment there's no way to gather all the data from the thousands of trials together.
The single best thing we can do to protect clinical research participants is to begin collecting those data to know what we do that really protects people. And it's not going to be cheap to do.
There have been widespread calls for a central database of clinical trials, but Emanuel says it must contain the right information to be useful. As things stand, says Senator Grassley, we protect our animal research guinea pigs better than we do the humankind. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
In about 6 weeks, we're going to launch a special series looking at the American consumer economy, why we keep buying as much stuff as we do, and whether or not that's sustainable. We had Tess Vigeland on a couple of weeks ago with a sneak preview of part of her reporting for us. She's been looking not so much at the consumption of consumer goods, but what comes out the other end, if you will. She's been hauling around her trash for the past few weeks, and we've got her back in for an update. Hey, Tess.
Hi, Kai.
We probably ought to start, in the interest of full disclosure, by saying I haven't actually seen you and your trash bag in a couple of three, 4 days. What's the update here?
Well, Kai, you wouldn't have seen it with me over the last couple of days. This trash challenge was to last for 2 weeks. I was hoping to carry my trash around, but because of my lack of knowledge in the early days of the challenge, I started putting things in there that eventually ended up stinking up the joint. And by the time, Tuesday rolled around this week, there was no way I was going to be bringing that into the office or carting it around in my car because it was intolerable. So, RIP, my bag is in the trash.
All right, so let's go back to the thing you learned, though, which is that garbage smells, which is all well and good. But what about that original objective you had, which was to get down, hopefully at the end of this, to generating zero trash? How'd you do?
Well, it's very tough to get down to zero. It depends how dedicated you are. It requires real effort. And it also depends on what programs your city provides. Some cities have recycling programs, but they're very restrictive, like no black plastic. I've heard of this. I'm pretty sure at this point that I was also recycling things that are going to end up in the landfill, because what I've learned is that cities will often say, give us all of the recyclable material that you think is viable. Well, without real specifics, you don't know exactly how much of what you're throwing in the recycle can is ending up in a landfill.
Seems to me what happens here, Tess, though, is that you have to think about the front end before you think about the back end, right? What you're buying and then eventually what's going to end up in the trash stream.
Right, and how much extra packaging there is on so much of what we buy. You know, one of my Trash Challenge followers suggested that we all take all of our non-compostable, non-recyclable packaging back to the store we bought it from and say, hey, we're returning the unneeded part of our purchase. That would certainly get their attention, but that's not necessarily going to do anything to get the manufacturers not to place so much extra packaging on everything that we buy.
Okay, wait, you have a Trash Challenge follower thing going?
I have many, many Trash Challenge followers. I've had several listeners who have decided to join the challenge, and they've faced some of the same obstacles that I have. But, you know, in all, there really are solutions out there. Some of them are very expensive. Some are very easy. Just watch what you're buying. Make every effort to recycle. But, you know, getting off this whole idea of a trash grid, I don't know if it's possible unless I stop buying anything.
Which, of course, kind of defeats the purpose of a consumer economy to begin with, right?
That's right. And the question there, which we are going to be asking in the Consume series in November, is how much of that is sustainable? Do we really need all the stuff we buy? And I'll tell you from this trash experiment, I probably don't need all the stuff I buy.
Marketplace's Tess Vigeland hosts our weekend personal finance program. It's called Marketplace Money. She has also been hauling around her trash for a couple of weeks. You can become one of her Trash Challenge followers by clicking on our website. It's marketplace.org. The link you're looking for says sustainability. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Guy.
Service clubs have a long and proud tradition in this country, Shriners and their work for children's hospitals, along with Moose and Elk clubs. But when was the last time you met one of those guys who was under the age of about 65? You never have you? Because since about the 1980s, the clubs have been struggling to survive, competing against families, careers, and a healthy dose of cynicism. But a resurgence of sorts seems to be developing, as Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us.
A stylish golden elk head looks out over Hoboken's trendy Washington Street. It looks right at home among the neighborhood's upscale restaurants and boutiques, so it's a surprise to find it marks the entrance to a basement bar where 82-year-old retirees play poker with men half a century younger.
Full house.
Nine.
Yeah. Three nines.
This is Lodge number 74 of the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks. The Elks have lost more than 600,000 members nationwide since 1980. Older Elks have died off and younger ones have lost interest. But thanks to Lodge 74 and others in Austin, Denver, and San Francisco, officials say that decline is slowing down. The Hoboken Lodge inducted close to 30 new members a few months ago, and officials say 70% of active Hoboken Elks are younger than 40. That surprised 37-year-old Karen Babiak. She pictured the typical elk as a crusty old man.
Probably served in about three wars, sits on his front step, wants to, you know, get these kids out of the neighborhood, that kind of thing. But we found a lot of people that were younger and also a lot of interest, like the older people even are really interesting.
Babiak and her boyfriend applied just last week to join the lodge. The Elks have allowed women since 1995. 36-year-old Jason Alvarez belonged to a fraternity in college and says he missed the community service. Each year, the Elks raise millions for college scholarships, kids with cerebral palsy, drug education. But the lodge also offers a kitschy place to hang out, complete with jukebox, pool table, and $5 buffet.
This is a nice place to come down to. You can actually hear each other talk without blaring music, play a little pool, a little pinball. and just have a good time without having to fight your way to the bar to get a beer and pay exorbitant beer prices.
The Elks like to talk a lot about the beer.
Anywhere else on the Strip, a beer go for $4, $5, $6. You come here, the most you pay is $2. You can't get that nowhere else, you know?
It's about being an Elk, cheap beer and community service, and by the way, in that order.
The Elks aren't the only service club attracting new members. Last year, the Moose Fraternity grew for the first time in more than a decade. The Masons saw their smallest decline in years. Mike Andrews is spokesman for the Shriners. He says the average age of new members is falling. This fall, the Shriners plan to launch a recruiting campaign. They may even start wooing college students.
Much in the same way that IBM or Microsoft or any of the large corporations recruit on college campuses, because we think when young men find out what we have to offer, we think there'll be an interest in joining our ranks.
The quest for younger members has created some tension with old-timers. Jack Bedeau Jr. is a former exalted ruler with the Elks of Ontario, California. That's Elk speak for president. He says he worked hard last year to bring the average age down to 66. It had been in the 70s. One tactic, Bedeau says he switched from ballroom music on Friday nights to something a little more current.
I made sure that I didn't get out of control. I certainly didn't mess around with hard rock and roll. Now, top 40s is kind of where I'm talking about.
50-50 can't win unless you're in.
At the Elks Lodge in Hoboken, Edward Yulvig sells tickets for a raffle benefiting disabled children. He's 83. He doesn't mind the newcomers, except for one thing.
Nobody participates. What I mean by that is they join as members, they pay their dues, but you don't see them.
But after decades of declines, longtime Elks say they'd rather have card-carrying, dues-paying members than no members at all. In Hoboken, New Jersey, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. Publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to bring the week to a merciful close. About a month ago, we brought you George Hotz, the New Jersey teenager who was the first to break up the iPhone's marriage to its AT&T wireless carrier.
I partied and I unlocked the iPhone. It was a good summer.
Well, the party may now be over. At midnight last night, Apple released a software update that has rendered many hacked iPhones useless. iBricks, they're being called. Since George posted his hacking methods on YouTube, we can only speculate as to how many people have been affected by the crackdown. Apple says that hacking those phones amounts to a breach of warranty. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 17 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq lost 8 points, that is 0.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 4 points, that is 0.3% there as well. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Thanks this week to the staff here at Minnesota Public Radio. Coming up on Monday, Subway sandwiches go fast, fresh, and kosher.
All these Orthodox people, all the kids, they all watch the same, you know, TV programs as everybody else, but their whole life they can't eat here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.